Chrome Yellow by Aldous Huxley, read for LibriVox.org by Martin Clifton. Chapter 14. For their after-luncheon coffee, the party generally adjourned to the library. Its windows looked east, and at this hour of the day it was the coolest place in the whole house. It was a large room, fitted, during the 18th century, with white painted shelves of an elegant design. In the middle of one wall, a door, ingeniously upholstered with rows of dummy books, gave access to a deep cupboard, where, among a pile of letter files and old newspapers, the mummy case of an Egyptian lady, brought back by the second Sir Ferdinando on his return from the Grand Tour, mouldered in the darkness. From 10 yards away, and at first glance, one might almost have mistaken this secret door for a section of shelving filled with genuine books. Coffee cup in hand, Mr. Scogan was standing in front of the dummy bookshelf. Between the sips, he discoursed. "The bottom shelf," he was saying, "is taken up by an encyclopedia in 14 volumes. Useful, but a little dull, as is also Caprimulge's Dictionary of the Finnish Language. The biographical dictionary looks more promising. Biography of men who were born great. Biography of men who achieved greatness, biography of men who had greatness thrust upon them, and biography of men who were never great at all. Then there are 10 volumes of Tom's Works and Wanderings, while The Wild Goose Chase, a novel, by an anonymous author, fills no less than 6. But what's this? What's this?" Mr. Scogan stood on tiptoe and peered up. 7 volumes of The Tales of Knockenspotch. "The Tales of Knockenspotch," he repeated. "Ah, my dear Henry," he said, turning round, "these are your best books. I would willingly give all the rest of your library for them." The happy possessor of a multitude of first editions, Mr. Wimbush, could afford to smile indulgently. "Is it possible," Mr. Scogan went on, "that they possess nothing more than a back and a title?" He opened the cupboard door and peeped inside, as though he hoped to find the rest of the books behind it. "Phew!" he said, and shut the door again. "It smells of dust and mildew. How symbolical. One comes to the great masterpieces of the past, expecting some miraculous illumination, and one finds, on opening them, only darkness and dust and a faint smell of decay. After all, what is reading but a vice, like drink or venery or any other form of excessive self-indulgence? One reads to tickle and amuse one's mind. One reads, above all, to prevent oneself thinking. Still, The Tales of Knockenspotch..." He paused and thoughtfully drummed with his fingers on the backs of the non-existent, unattainable books. "But I disagree with you about reading," said Mary. "About serious reading, I mean." "Quite right, Mary, quite right," Mr. Scogan answered. "I had forgotten there were any serious people in the room." "I like the idea of biographies," said Denis. "There's room for us all within the scheme. It's comprehensive." "Yes, the biographies are good, the biographies are excellent," Mr. Scogan agreed. "I imagine them written in a very elegant Regency style. Brighton Pavilion in words, perhaps by the greatest de Lamprière himself. You know his classical dictionary?" "Ah," Mr. Scogan raised his hand and let it limply fall again in a gesture which implied that words failed him. "Read his biography of Helen. Read how Jupiter, disguised as a swan, was enabled to avail himself of the situation, vis-à-vis to Leda. And to think that he may have, must have written these biographies of the great. What a work, Henry. And owing to the idiotic arrangement of your library, it can't be read." "I prefer The Wild Goose Chase," said Anne, "a novel in 6 volumes. It must be restful." "Restful," Mr. Scogan repeated. "You've hit on the right word. A wild goose chase is sound, but a bit old-fashioned. Pictures of clerical life in the 50s, you know, specimens of the landed gentry, peasants for pathos and comedy, and in the background always the picturesque beauties of nature soberly described. All very good and solid, but, like certain puddings, just a little dull. Personally, I like much better the notion of Tom's Works and Wanderings. The eccentric Mr. Tom of Tom's Hill, old Tom Tom, as his intimates used to call him. He spent 10 years in Tibet organizing the clarified butter industry on modern European lines, and was able to retire at 36 with a handsome fortune. The rest of his life he devoted to travel and ratiocination. Here is the result." Mr. Scogan tapped the dummy books. "And now we come to The Tales of Knockenspotch. What a masterpiece, and what a great man. Knock and Spotch knew how to write fiction. Ah, Denis, if you could only read Knock and Spotch, you wouldn't be writing a novel about the wearisome development of a young man's character. You wouldn't be describing in endless, fastidious detail cultured life in Chelsea and Bloomsbury and Hampstead. You would be trying to write a readable book. But then, alas, owing to the peculiar arrangement of our host's library, you will never read Knock and Spotch. Nobody could regret the fact more than I do, said Denis. It was Knock and Spotch, Mr. Scogan continued, the great Knock and Spotch, who delivered us from the dreary tyranny of the realistic novel. My life, Knock and Spotch said, is not so long that I can afford to spend precious hours writing or reading descriptions of middle-class interiors. He said again, I am tired of seeing the human mind bogged in a social plenum. I prefer to paint it in a vacuum, freely and sportively bombinating. I say, said Gombauld, Knock and Spotch was a little obscure sometimes, wasn't he? He was, Mr. Scogan replied, and with intention. It made him seem even profounder than he actually was. But it was only in his aphorisms that he was so dark and oracular. In his tales he was always luminous. Oh, those tales, how shall I describe them? Fabulous characters shoot across his pages like gaily dressed performers on the trapeze. There are extraordinary adventures and still more extraordinary speculations. Intelligences and emotions, relieved of all the imbecile preoccupations of civilized life, move in intricate and subtle dances, crossing and recrossing, advancing, retreating, impinging. An immense erudition and an immense fancy go hand in hand. All the ideas of the present and of the past, on every possible subject, bob up among the tales, smile gravely or grimace at a caricature of themselves, then disappear to make place for something new. The verbal surface of his writing is rich and fantastically diversified. The wit is incessant. But couldn't you give us a specimen? Denis broke in. A concrete example? Alas, Mr. Scogan replied, Knock and Spotch's great book is like the sword Excalibur. It remains stuck fast in this door, awaiting the coming of a writer with genius enough to draw it forth. I am not even a writer. I am not so much as qualified to attempt the task. The extraction of Knock and Spotch from this wooden prison I leave, my dear Denis, to you. Thank you, said Denis. End of chapter.